My name is Michael McCusker. I have a few things to read this morning, a little bit of a potpourri. I'd like to start with an article written a few years back by a friend of mine, R. Lewis Richards, aka the 99th Monkey. And it was published in my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle. And he lives near Nacelle. And he's moving to Idaho, and this might give you a good reason after I read this article. Clear-Cut Feelings by R. Lewis Richards. They had at times stood stark still, listening long to the greatest of silences. At others, they leaned back and danced as dervishes with the spray of life's waters through their bows, assisting each other's balance against hurricane and gale. They had known the screams of lions and eagles and the chatters of squirrels and songbirds. They arose in a world where death had always come in the time best suited to life and its relations. Now, it seems, a general death has come to this forest and the families of its wild community. It has arrived out of time as its naked self, with no life about it at all. I watched this clear-cutting proceed, sitting concealed in a natural blind at the edge of some trees. Trees that are, as evidenced by colored ribbons and spray-painted marks, soon to be another scene of destruction. Over a few short weeks I have watched since that morning when I was alerted by the foreign sound of whistles, signaling the movements of the yarder's long cables. I came up here to find this war, this sad battlefield. Helmeted and red suspendered soldiers used weapons that fired and refired the same chromium razor bullets on continuous revolving chains. The fallen victims were strangled and dragged away by a noose. Yellow and orange metal beasts seemed to dine on the larger body parts within the broken circle. For now, the industry will shift its focus to other ridges and canyons. A seemingly absolute and final silence has fallen loudly with the departure of truck and yarder tower. As I walk out into the freshly killed landscape, the pungent smell of sap, almost overpowering, mingles with and covers the damp aroma of the ripped open surface soils. The Douglas firs smell stronger than the cedars, spruces, and hemlocks. All are trying by the power of that ancient intelligence to seal off their terminal injuries. Big leaf and vine maples will crystallize their sugars at the point of severance and try to grow back from the roots come spring. Prolific alders sprouting from millions of seeds together with the tenacious maples and countless dozens of varieties of shrubs, ferns, flowers, and berries will proclaim their regenerative life force, only to be poisoned back to a grotesque and slow living death by a rain of hormonal disruptors sprayed down from venomous helicopters. With birds, bugs, and weed trees, and that's a quote, absent, one engineered and cloned variety of tree, one variety for which the industry projects a profitable future market, will be substituted for the genocided diversity. The familiar odor of the Douglas firs has transported me back to a Christmas tree lot on a December corner of my childhood. I remember creeping through a sawed-off pygmy forest. The sacrificial young firs were trucked in and resurrected upon wooden crosses along the boulevard just a block away from my family's stuccoed box of a home in L.A.'s suburbs. I was a 7-year-old wild man, crawling, knees and elbows, ducking below the branches and avoiding giant alien invaders known as such by their habit of walking upright. I stand here now and identify as a returned forest dweller, ironically reincarnated in Smogville. I never felt at home until I found a real forest. Now it gets ever harder to find one. After 3 weeks of opaque gray, the sky this day is showing that depth of blue that only comes here from the far north with winter's dense Arctic air masses. November has brought, once again, a drenching to the western slopes of the Cascades. The place where I stand was wholly unprepared to accept the rain, rain that in other years would have been readily welcomed. An ethereal ghost forest stands upon a congregation of empty, weeping stumps. Amid dissevered branches, trampled ferns, piles of sawdust, and ripped-up duff, the scents of fir, cedar, and spruce are strong, far too strong. Like the image of the severed phantom leaf of Carilion photography, the old trees are holding on to their auric fields. Organized life currents and static electricity invisibly describe missing trunks, limbs, and needles. Energetic impulses above me in the static air strain to pull missing sap where it can no longer flow. This community of trees with its ferns and fungi, salamanders and birds, squirrels and bears, has been surprised by a sudden, sweeping, and unnatural change. Even at this height of trauma, it desperately strives to heal itself. The primal instinct inherent in each living organism seeks to maintain the energetic patterns of its material form. But the single, marketable portion of some central and essential life forms within this diverse system have been removed, trucked away to a muddy sorting yard in a noisy valley below. I could hear little but the roar of the churning chocolate stream as I made my way up the damp canyon. The scene up here in the cut is eerily silent except for my frequent falling down in the slippery mud and the springy web of slash. I arrived just before the big yarder machine was pulled away from its small circle of bare ground within a large square of newly opened sky. I hid and watched, hearing the loud, cracking exhaust of the diesel tractor as the telescoped tower slowly began to move. Left on the puddled, muddy landing are fragments of cables, some pop and tobacco cans, leaked or spilled black and red oils, a cracked blue plastic bucket, and a few empty oil bottles. Ringing the abandoned landing is a broken circle of a mound. It is crudely penetrated from upslope by the dead end of a now useless, coarsely rocked road. The mound is built up from tens of thousands of discarded limbs and treetops in a tangled heap. The yarder's towers, guys, and holds, thick steel ropes, yesterday were released from six huge stumps and coiled, each on its own spool. The last forced utility demanded of these six great entities was to facilitate the destruction of their neighbors and kin. These patient giants, not long before, had stood in random ranks as they had for over 500 peaceful years. It is 4 days later. Again, I am standing here amid the post-sylvan debris. The open soils that have smelled of a living dampness have quickly dried to a hard dustiness that rises in my footsteps. With four clear days and the nights of freeze-drying chill, the roots of the disappeared trees, in a futile effort to quench the thirst of their phantom bodies, have sucked all moisture from the land's surface. The misty fogs that have hung about above in the community of crowns each fall morning for 1,000 years have vanished into the blue vacuum. I have purposely stayed away for 3 days. After fasting and imbibing teas brewed from local shamanic botanicals, I have drummed, danced, prayed, and dreamed of this place for 4 nights. It has come up in my visions, projected in silver green against a deep bottom of the ocean blue-black. I saw again great trees standing as if still alive in the silvery shapes of self-effulgent light. What was most peculiar in my dreamscape was that I could clearly hear the voices of these trees. That they could regain and display their structure and form seemed at first wonderful, but then the hearing of the voices opened to me an empathy of torment. What I heard was akin to the moans, sobs, and wails of mothers come to retrieve the bodies of their good children from a bloody field of battle. Now, as I walk this scene in waking daylight, my dream sounds come back too real. I ascend a steep ridge toward the largest stump in the clearcut. It was the giant tree I had known as the biggest for miles. Taking on a temporary distance from the reality of my feelings, I have decided to go up and count its annual rings. For a few moments, I forcefully detach from my emotions. I enter the quantified mindset of commerce, where trees are but logs. I try to think about bored feet and how many houses that one trunk could make, the body of that single incredible big tree. Instead, what I see is a man behind glass, high above a city, adding figures in a column. I decidedly reject that mentality, which has become strange to me. How could I forget my time sitting with my back pressed against this familiar friend? Not for even 2 minutes can this be done. This tree, my loved and respected intimate, was murdered, and its massive middle has unceremoniously been hauled away. Its topmost tip, that each year has borne 10,000 flying seeds, now lies almost a football field's length above me up this ridge. I can only climb atop the great stump from the uphill side. The downslope's drop is all of 12 feet. Standing on its edge, I survey the expanse of denuded landscape. I see a half-mile by half-mile square of terminated natural progress. I try to numb out again. No use. I lay down on my back, arms thrown back above my head. My feet and hands are inside the 6-inch thick bark-lined perimeter. How long had this gentle giant waited for such a violent end? I again resolve to count the rings. Rolling over and rising up to my hands and knees, I began to push my index finger out from the center dot, counting each concentric circle. At least 5 years, I'm thinking, to reach the elevation of the stump. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The rings start out quite wide. This tree probably grew up in a burn started by a pre-Columbian lightning strike. Standing as it had on the south face of this promontory ridge, it would have had a head start of maybe 15 years of rank growth before the maple and alder began getting most of the summer light, narrowing the annual rings. As the rings in the 20s began to thin down, I look ahead of my finger. Across so many hundreds of years, I have yet to tally, and my eyes fill with tears. I can no longer see to count. I look up from all fours at the blurry nightmare of this damaged world. My grief is heavy upon me. In sad hopelessness, I lay my forehead at the center of the concentric unbroken circles where my beloved tree's natural being was terminated. At once, I feel the sensation of falling. Eyes tightly closed, my visual sense is of diving headfirst into the dark earth. All is now seen in the same luminous silver light of my nights of dream visions. I see myself passing through the giant roots tied securely to fractures in the rock. Salamanders, grubs, and worms sense my presence and telepathically acknowledge my passing. I see them glowing within iridescent rainbow auras. I tumble through layers of basalt and sandstone. I feel my breathing light and easy, and my lungs fill with something so much finer than air. I sense I am being wordlessly informed by coupling with an intelligence coming into me through my own heart center. An expansive and timeless feeling in my chest occupies the whole focus of my sensory experience. A knowing arises from within me in a language that this is only the singularity of the joy which is life. And that's a quote. I laugh inside because the words that form seem the single greatest attainment of understatement. My thinking mind tries to intrude upon the experience, but this is entirely too vast. Irrelevant thoughts can only surrender and dissipate before the magnitude of the feelings. My focus begins to shift, to expand. And I see Earth as a translucent planetary bubble. I know instinctively and immediately of every kindred spirit and where around an entire planet they endure. I see how many we are, so many pulsating lights connected by loving threads in the oneness of our intention. A voice congeals out of the fluid totality of my sensations. A voice both male and female resonates with a rhythmic flickering of the silver glow in all the living centers, saying clearly, "Take heart, don't give up, defend my earth." With the feeling of sudden shock, I jerk my head up to see the full moon rising in twilight over the clearcut. I will spend this cold night here on the stump, warmed from within. I feel strengthened in a way I cannot fully grasp. That my life will never be the same is all I can ascertain. And that was Clearcut Feelings by R. Lewis Richards, Akka, the 99th monkey. And he does live in along the Columbia River near Nacelle, Washington. And he is planning to move further inland, back into old forest country. I promised him, or said to him, I would read it last week, but I had forgotten a couple of other things, so I hope he is listening. And along a sort of a subject of the same, I'd like to read something from the New York Times of September 8th, Sunday, by Verlin Klinkenborg, who writes a great deal of farming and gardening and forestry. "Hey, you calling me an invasive species?" Since the 1880s, there have been blue gum eucalyptus trees growing on San Francisco's Mount Sutro, which lies just south of Golden Gate Park. Recently, the University of California, San Francisco, which owns most of Mount Sutro, has been trying to thin the dense eucalyptus forest. The reason is fire control. Eucalyptus trees are fire-intensive, and as an old hotshot in the Angeles National Forest, believe me, they are. They're torches. Fire-intensive are eucalyptus trees, Ecalaspidus trees, shedding a lot of debris and burning with unusual volatility. But the effort to cull the Mount Sutro forest has been met with strident protest by residents who want to see the eucalyptus left untouched. By the standard of the California Native Plant Society, eucalyptus, which were brought from Australia, are officially non-native trees because they were introduced after the first European contact with the New World. But the trees on Mount Sutro have been there within the memory of every living San Franciscan, and to the generations who have grown up within view of them, it seems almost perverse to insist that they are aliens. To keep a clear distinction between native and non-native species requires nearly geologic memory. But humans, like most species, don't live in the past, where the distinction originates. In the present, the difference is largely immaterial. Native or non-native, California's eucalyptus trees, like the starlings of Central Park, have come to seem original just because they predate us. Of course, the vast majority of non-native species have not been intentionally introduced, as the Mount Sutro eucalyptus were, but have been distributed accidentally, unnoticed baggage in the wanderings of our species. Some species, invasive ones like kudzu, Japanese knotweed, rabbits, and rats, find almost unlimited room for expansion in their new environs, often overwhelming native species. But not all introduced species are invasive and pose a threat only when they outcompete native species. It is important to remember that the distinction between native and non-native depends on an imaginary snapshot of this continent taken just before European contact. That distinction is becoming even harder to make as climate change alters the natural world. A new study from the University of Exeter and Oxford University finds that plant pests and diseases have been migrating northward and southward, an average of 2 miles a year since 1960. This suggests that the plants on which they prey have been moving at similar rates. In places like the Adirondacks, for instance, you can follow the boundary between southern and northern tree species as it shifts northward year by year, as plants and their pests adjust their range under the influence of global warming, what becomes of the distinction between native and non-native. To any individual species, it doesn't matter whether it's native or not. The only thing that matters is whether its habitat is suitable. And this is where we come in. For the most part, we don't have an immediate impact on the species that surround us, but we do have an immediate impact on their habitat, which determines whether they survive or, in some cases, shift their ground. Nearly every habitat on this planet has been affected by humans, no matter how remote it is. In the past decade, for instance, the habitats of grizzly bears high in the Rocky Mountains, places most of us never get a chance to visit, have been significantly altered by global warming. As the climate warms, the mountain pine beetle has managed to winter over and destroy vast tracts of white bark pine trees, which produce pine nuts that bears eat. Considered in this light, the natural world as a whole begins to look like Central Park, an ecosystem where human influence is all pervasive. Parts of the park seem almost wild, but every creature in Central Park, native or not, has adapted to a world that is closely bounded by human activity. It is nature bordered by high-rises, intersected by paths and roadways, basking under artificial light at night. In late August, a group of scientists and students from the City University of New York's Macaulay Honors College spent the day cataloging all the non-domesticated life forms living in the park. It will take a while to compile and compare the data, but even the anecdotal reports from that single day show how diverse and surprising the park's ecosystem can be. It isn't all squirrels and pigeons. The group reported sightings of several unexpected species, a diamondback terrapin in Turtle Pond, a Wilson's warbler in the North Woods, a bullhead catfish in the Harlem Mere. And though it might seem like a stretch to talk about ecosystems in Central Park, that is exactly what the group found, a healthy mix of species, overlapping generations within many species, and a sense of balance, especially within the aquatic zones. Nature in Central Park can't not be neatly divided into native or non-native species, and neither can it be on Mount Sutro. The eucalyptus trees that grow there may be naturalized rather than native, but try telling that to all the other creatures that live in those woods or the people who hike there. And when it comes to the distinction between native and non-native, we always leave one species out. Call us what you will. Native, naturalized, alien, or invasive. And that was "Hey, You Calling Me an Invasive Species?" by Verlin Klinkenborg. And I heard him once on NPR talk about himself, why he writes what he writes and why he lives like he lives. And he's a very intelligent, very sagacious person. And I'm sorry for intruding with the into the eucalyptus. Eucalyptus groves really go up, and I remember more than once running through them as they're torching up above us and starting to fall down when I was a much younger person. Well, I'd like to read something now from the Vets for Peace. It was a letter in the Friday, September 13th, 2013, Daily Astorian. And it's an open letter to U.S. Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden and U.S. Representative Kurt Schrader, and was written by Brian McMahon. Veterans for Peace is a global organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace by using our experiences and lifting our voices. Local Chapter 164 of the Veterans for Peace consists of members living on the north coast of the great state of Oregon. We write to you today in response to President Obama's request to employ U.S. military forces to strike the Assad regime in Syria. As veterans, we know the true cost of war and take this proposal with the utmost of seriousness. The current situation in Syria is complex and fluid. The destruction and loss of life inflicted upon this country over the past 2 years is truly horrific. As veterans of numerous conflicts, we have seen and lived these horrors firsthand and have been forever changed. The alleged use of sarin gas to kill civilians in Syria is the latest action in a cycle of violence that has reportedly killed more than 100,000 and displaced 2 million. Indeed, the use of chemical weapons is morally reprehensible. It is just as morally reprehensible when the United States implicitly supported their use by Saddam Hussein to kill Iranians from 1983 to 1988. We believe that the United States can do more to end this conflict and help the victims of this war. As the most powerful nation on earth, we have the moral imperative to exhaust all other options before using military force. We don't believe this has happened in Syria. We request that you oppose United States military intervention at this time. And that was an open letter to U.S. Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden and U.S. Representative Kurt Schrader from the Vets for Peace, Chapter 164, Manzanita. And it was at least signed, if not written, by Brian McMahon of that chapter. And I believe he was on this program some months back. Well, this has been Michael McCusker on this rather beautiful Thursday morning here in Astoria, Oregon, as a friend of mine always calls it. I call it Astrovia. She calls it Astormia. And I suppose I might be back next Thursday if certain things do not occur, such as some of those spies in the skies incinerate me on the sidewalk. These drones that we seem to have put into our skies without any public favor or even vote. We've not been asked. We've just been told. And so now they're there. Just like the NSA is monitoring everything. And if you heard a story on the news this morning, even people taking pictures of dams and other things. You think this thing is going to stop? As long as the technology grows, so will the undersides of it. So this is KMUN, KTCB, Astoria Killamuck, 91.9 FM and 89.5 FM, Coast Community Radio. And next up, if I hit the right button, will be NPR News Headlines, perhaps preceded by a few seconds of wonderful, generally sparse silence. Good morning.